that would give her nightmares.
Penelope looked out at the basketball court.
No wonder you're so protective. She's all you have left of her father.
True. Unless you counted herpes. I was pregnant with Dee when he died. White-knuckling detox because I knew they would take her away from me if they found drugs in my system. I was lucky to have her. Dee saved my life.
Oh, honey.
Penelope grabbed Lydia's hand, and Lydia's heart sank as she realized that it had all been in vain. The story had obviously moved Penelope, or at least interested her, but she had come here with a task, and that task was going to be assigned.
But look, it's still part of Dee's heritage, right? I mean, step-families are still families. 31 kids at this school are adopted, but they still belong.
Lydia took a millisecond to process the statement. 31? As in, exactly 31?
I know.
Penelope took her shock at face value. The Harris twins just got into preschool. Their legacies. She lowered her voice.
Lice carrying legacies, if you believe the rumor.
Lydia opened her mouth, then closed it. Anyway, Penelope blasted another smile as she stood up. Just run the recipes by me first, okay? I know you like Dee to take on special skills projects. You're so lucky. Mom and daughter cooking together in the kitchen. Fun, fun.
Lydia held her tongue.
The only thing she and Dee did together in the kitchen was argue about when a mayonnaise jar was empty enough to be thrown away.
Thanks for volunteering!
Penelope jogged up the bleachers, pumping her arms with Olympic vigor. Lydia wondered how long it would take for Penelope to tell the other mothers about the tragic death of Lloyd Delgado. Her father always said that the price for hearing gossip was having someone else gossip about you. She wished that he were still alive so she could tell him about the mothers. He would have wet himself with laughter.
Coach Henley blew his whistle, indicating the girls should wind down their warm-up drills. The words, special skills projects, kept rolling around in Lydia's head. So here was confirmation that the mothers had noticed.
Lydia would not feel bad for making her daughter take a basic car maintenance class so that she would know how to change a flat tire. Nor did she regret making Dee enroll in a self-defense course over the summer, even if it meant that she missed basketball camp. Or insisting that Dee practice how to scream when she was scared, because Dee had a habit of freezing up when she was frightened, and being silent was the worst thing you could possibly do if there was a man in front of you who meant to do you harm. Lydia bet that right now, Anna Kilpatrick's mother was wishing she'd taught her daughter how to change a flat tire. The girl's car was found in the mall parking lot with a nail in the front tire. It wasn't a big leap to think that the person who'd driven in the nail was the same person who had abducted her. Coach Henley gave his whistle two short blasts to get the team moving. The Westerly women ambled over and formed a half circle. The mothers stamped their feet on the bleachers, trying to build excitement for a game that would unfold with the same drama as a mime's funeral. The opposing team hadn't even bothered to warm up. Their shortest player was 6 feet tall and had hands the size of dinner plates. The gym doors opened. Lydia saw Rick scan the crowd, and then he saw her. And then he looked at the opposing side's empty bleachers. She held her breath as he considered. Then she let it out as he made his way toward her. He slowly climbed the bleachers. People who worked for a living didn't tend to sprint up bleachers. He sat down beside Lydia with a groan. She said, "Hey." Rick picked up the empty bag of chips, leaned back his head, and let the crumbs fall into his mouth. Most of them went down his shirt into his collar. Lydia laughed because it was hard to hate someone who was laughing. He gave her a wary look. He knew her tactics.
Rick Butler was nothing like the fathers at Westerly. For one, he worked with his hands. He was a mechanic at a gas station that still pumped gas for some of their elderly customers. The muscles in his arms and chest came from lifting tires onto rims. The ponytail down his back came from not listening to the two women in his life who desperately wanted it gone. He was either a redneck or a hippie, depending on what kind of mood he was in. That she loved him in both incarnations had been the surprise of Lydia Delgado's life. He handed back the empty bag. There were specks of potato chips in his beard.
Nice stash.
She touched her fingers to her raw upper lip. Are we still fighting?
Are you still being grumpy?
My instinct tells me yes, she admitted. But I hate when we're mad at each other. I feel like my whole world is upside down. The buzzer sounded. They both winced as the game started, praying the humiliation would be brief. Miraculously, the Westerly women managed to get the tip-off. Even more miraculously, Dee was dribbling the ball down the court. Rick yelled, "Go, Delgado!" Dee obviously saw the looming shadows of three giant girls behind her. There was no one to pass to. She blindly heaved the ball toward the basket, only to watch it bounce off the backboard and drop into the empty bleachers on the other side of the gym. Lydia felt Rick's pinky finger stroke her pinky finger. He asked,
"How did she get so amazing?"
"Wheaties." Lydia could barely get the word out. Her heart always swelled when she saw how much Rick loved her daughter. She could forgive the ponytail for that alone.
"I'm sorry I've been such a bitch lately," she amended. "I mean, for the last decade." "I'm sure you were bitchy before that."
"I was a lot more fun." He raised his eyebrow. They had met at a 12-step meeting 13 years ago. Neither one of them had been a lot of fun.
"I was thinner," she tried. "Sure, that's what matters."
Rick kept his eyes on the game.
"What's gotten into you, babe? Every time I open my mouth lately, you howl like a scalded dog."
"Aren't you glad we're not living together?"
"We gonna have that fight again?"
She almost started to. The words, "But why do we need to live together when we live right next door to each other," were right on the tip of her tongue. The effort didn't go unnoticed.
"Nice to see you can keep your mouth shut when you really want to."
He whistled as Dee tried for 3 points. The ball missed, but he still gave her a thumbs up when she glanced his way. Lydia was tempted to tell him that Dee wouldn't give a rat's ass about his approval if they lived together, but decided to save it for the next time they were yelling at each other. Rick sighed as the opposing team got the ball.
"Oh, Lord, here we go."
The dinner plate girl was blocking Dee. She didn't even have the decency to raise her arms. Rick sat back against the bleachers. His boots rested on the seat in front of him. There were oil stains on the cracked brown leather. His jeans had grease spots. He smelled faintly of engine exhaust. He had kind eyes. He loved her daughter. He loved animals, even squirrels. He had read every book Danielle Steele had ever written because he got hooked in rehab. He didn't mind that most of Lydia's clothes were covered in dog hair, or that her only regret about their sex life was that she couldn't do it wearing a burqa. She asked, "What do I need to do?"
"Tell me what's going on in that crazy head of yours."
"I'd tell you, but then I'd have to kill you." He thought it over for a moment.
"All right, just don't mess up my face."
Lydia stared at the scoreboard. 10-0. She blinked. 12-0. She didn't know how to say what she needed to say. "It's just history coming back on me."
"That sounds like a country music song."
He looked her in the eye.
"Anna Kilpatrick."
Lydia chewed her lip. He wasn't asking a question. He was giving an answer.
He'd seen all the clippings she'd kept on Anna Kilpatrick's disappearance, the way Lydia's eyes filled with tears whenever the girl's parents were on the news. He said,
"I heard the police found a new clue.
All they can do now is hope they find the body.
She might be alive."
"Optimism is a sliver of glass in your heart."
"That from another song?"
"From my father." He smiled at her. She loved the way the lines around his eyes crinkled.
"Babe, I know I asked you to stay away from the news, but I think you should know something."
Rick wasn't smiling anymore. She felt her heart lurch in her chest.
"Is she dead?"
Lydia put her hand to her throat.
"Did they find Anna?" "No, I would have told you right off. You know that."
She did know that, but her heart was still racing.
"I saw it in the crime blotter this morning."
Rick was visibly reluctant, but he pushed on.
"It happened 3 days ago. Paul Scott, architect, married to Claire Scott. They were downtown. Got robbed. Paul took the wrong end of a knife. Died before they got him to the hospital. Funeral's tomorrow."
The mothers erupted into another round of cheering and clapping. Dee had somehow managed to get the ball again. Lydia watched her daughter sprint down the court. Dinner plate hands snatched away the ball. Dee didn't give up. She chased after the girl. She was fearless. She was fearless in every aspect of her life. And why wouldn't she be? No one had ever slapped her down. Life hadn't had a chance to hurt her. She had never lost anyone. She had never known the sorrow of having someone taken away. Rick asked,
"You gonna say something?"
Lydia had a lot to say, but she wasn't going to let Rick see that side of her, that angry, brutal side that she'd anesthetized with coke and, when the coke was too much, pushed down with food.
"Liddy."
She shook her head. Tears streamed down her face.
"I just hope he suffered."
Part 2.
"It's your birthday today. The fourth birthday that has passed without you. As usual, I set aside some time to go through our family photos and let all of the memories wash over me. I only allow myself this pleasure once a year, because doling out these precious memories is what gets me through the countless, endless days without you. My favorite photograph is from your first birthday. Your mother and I were far more excited than you were, though you were generally a happy baby. To you, this birthday was just another day. Nothing remarkable except the cake, which you immediately destroyed with your fists. There were only two of us on the guest list. Your mother said it was silly to publicly mark an event that you would never remember. I readily agreed, because I was selfish, and because I was never happier than when I had my girls all to myself. I timed myself as the memories ebbed and flowed. 2 hours. No more, no less. Then I carefully placed the pictures back into the box, closed the lid, and put them on the shelf for next year. Next, as is my routine, I walked to the sheriff's office. He stopped returning my calls long ago. I could see the dread in his eyes when he saw me through the glass partition. I am his challenger. I am his failure. I am his pathetic pain in the ass who won't accept the truth that his daughter walked away. Our first birthday without you, I went to the sheriff's office and calmly requested to read all of the files pertaining to your case. He refused. I threatened to call the newspaper. He told me to go ahead. I went to the payphone in the lobby. I slotted in a quarter. He came over and hung up the phone and told me to follow him back into the squad room. We performed this same kabuki theater year after year, until finally, this year, he gave up without a fight. A deputy led me back to a small interrogation room where they had laid out copies of all the files pertaining to your investigation. He offered me a glass of water, but I pointed to my lunchbox and thermos and told him I was fine. There is no clear narrative to a police report. Your file has no beginning, middle, and end. There are summaries of witness statements, most of their names unhelpfully blacked out. Handwritten notes from detectives that use a language I have yet to master. Statements that have proven to be false, and others suspected to be false, again blacked out statements, that have proven to be true. Everybody lies to some degree when questioned by the police. And interview notes with a paltry list of suspects. Yes, their names are all blacked out like the others. Two different types of maps have been taped together, one showing downtown and the other showing the campus, so that your last known footsteps can be traced across town. There are also photographs. Your dorm room with favorite clothes unaccounted for, toiletries mysteriously gone, textbooks abandoned, reports half finished, a missing bicycle, though it was later found. The first sheet of paper in your file is the same sheet of paper I saw on the first anniversary of your birthday, then the second, the third, and now the fourth. Case pending until farther leads. Your mother would have used a red pen to correct the word to further, but I take craven pleasure in knowing that, from the very first page, they are wrong. This is what the weather was like on Monday, March 4th, 1991. The high was 51 degrees, the low was 37. The skies were cloudless. There was no precipitation. The dew point was 34 degrees. Winds came out of the northwest at 16 miles per hour. There were 12 hours and 23 minutes of visible daylight. These were some of the items in the news that week. The murder trial of Pamela Smart began. Rodney King was beaten by members of the Los Angeles Police Department. A United Airlines flight went down near Colorado Springs. President Bush declared the Iraq War was over. You disappeared. Here are the sheriff's explanations for why he thinks you left us. You were angry with us because we wouldn't let you live off campus. You were furious that we would not let you drive to Atlanta for a concert. You had been arguing with your sister about the provenance of a straw hat. You had stopped speaking to your grandmother because she had implied that you were gaining weight. The sheriff has no children of his own. He does not understand that these high states of emotion are simply a byproduct of being a 19-year-old young woman. These disagreements were such minor storms in our family ecosystem that, at the start of the investigation, we failed to mention even one of them. Which, to his thinking, meant that we were trying to hide something. In fairness, you were no stranger to the police. You had been arrested twice before. The first time you were caught in a secure lab at the university protesting the research of genetically modified organisms. The second time, you were caught smoking pot in the back of Wuxtry, the record store where your friend Sally worked. Here are the so-called clues the sheriff cites to support his runaway theory. Your toothbrush and hairbrush were gone, or maybe you'd accidentally left them in the communal shower. A small leather satchel was missing from your roommate's closet, or maybe she'd let a friend use it for spring break. Some of your clothes seemed to be missing or borrowed without your permission. Most damningly, you had left an unfinished love letter on your desk. Kiss you in Paris,
hold your hand in Rome. Here, said the sheriff, was proof that you were planning to leave. Here, said your sister, was proof that you were writing a music review of Madonna's Justify My Love. There was a boy. Though any father of a teenage girl can tell you there is always a boy. He had ruffled hair and rolled his own cigarettes and talked about his feelings far too much for my comfort. You were interested in him, which meant you weren't really dating yet. There were notes being passed back and forth, records of late-night phone calls, soulful mixtapes delivered. You were both so young. This was the beginning of something that might lead to everything or nothing at all. To answer the obvious question, the boy was camping with his family when you were taken. He had an airtight alibi. A park ranger had seen him with the family. The man had stopped by their campsite to warn them that a coyote had been sighted in the area. He sat with the family by the fire and discussed football with the father because the boy was not a fan. The park ranger's contribution to the case did not stop there. He offered the sheriff a possible explanation, an explanation the sheriff later presented as fact. That same week, the ranger had come across a band of stragglers camping in the woods. They had been moving around the state for a while. They dressed in dark clothing. They cooked their meals on an open fire. They walked down country roads with their hands clasped behind their backs and their heads down. Drugs were involved, because with these sorts of characters, drugs are always involved. Some called them a cult. Others said they were homeless. Many said they were runaways. Most called them a nuisance. You, my sweet girl, were heard by many of your friends sympathetically referring to them as free spirits, which is why the sheriff assumed that, lacking any other leads, you had simply run off to join them. You volunteered at the homeless shelter, and you drank alcohol even though you were underage, and you were caught smoking pot, so it only made sense. By the time the runaway theory became cemented in the sheriff's mind, the group of stragglers, the cult, the free spirits, whatever they were called, had moved on. They were eventually located in North Carolina, too stoned and too disbanded to say who had been among them.
"She looks very familiar,"
one of the few remaining original members had written in his statement. "But we all have eyes and noses and teeth, so doesn't that mean that everybody looks familiar?" "This is why we know you were abducted. You were mad at your mother, but you still came home the day before and talked to her in the kitchen while you did your laundry. You were furious with your sister, but you still let her borrow your yellow scarf. You despised your grandmother, but you still left a card to be mailed the following week for her birthday. While it is not entirely out of the realm of possibility that you would run into the woods and join a group of aimless, wandering vagabonds, it is completely impossible that you would ever do so without telling us first. This is what we know you did on the day you were taken. At 7:30, on the morning of Monday, March 4th, you joined some friends from the homeless shelter and went to Hot Corner to pass out food and blankets. At 9:48 a.m., Carlene Loper, the desk monitor at Lipscomb Hall, was on duty and recorded your return to the dorm. Your roommate, Nancy Griggs, left for the pottery lab at 10:15 a.m. She said you were tired and had gone back to bed. Your English professor remembers you from his noon workshop. He offered you some editorial suggestions on your Spencer paper. He recalls a lively discussion. He was later ruled out as a suspect because that evening he was teaching a class on the other side of campus. Around 1 p.m., you went to the Tate Student Center where you ate a grilled cheese sandwich and a salad that you shared with Veronica Voorhees. The next part is less specific, but based on interviews, the sheriff managed to put together a likely list of your activities. At some point, you dropped by the Red and Black offices to deliver your story on UGA's attempt to privatize meal services. You returned to the student center and played a game of pool with a boy named Ezekiel Mann. You sat on the tweed couches in the lounge with another boy named David Conford. He told you that he'd heard Michael Stipe, the lead singer of R.E.M., would be at the Manhattan Cafe that night. Friends in the vicinity claim that Conford asked you to go with him, but he insists that he did not ask you out on a date. "We were just friends," he said in his statement. The deputy who interviewed him made a note that the boy had obviously wanted to be more. Witnesses placed both Mann and Conford in the student center later that evening. On or around 4:30 p.m. that afternoon, you left the Tate. You walked home, leaving your bike outside the student center, likely because it was getting colder and you didn't want to freeze going down Baxter Hill. 2 weeks later, your bike was found chained to the rack outside the center. According to the desk monitor, by 5 p.m. you were back in your dorm room. Your roommate Nancy recalls your excitement when you told her that Michael Stipe was going to be at the Manhattan. You both decided you would get a group together and go later that night. You were all underage, but you knew John McAllister, a townie who worked the front door, from high school. Nancy made several calls to friends. A meeting time of 9:30 p.m. was arranged. Since your psych professor had scheduled an exam before spring break, you and Nancy went to the North Library to study. Around 8:30 p.m., you were both seen at the taco stand, a restaurant, catty corner from the black iron arch that stands at the main campus entrance. You took the food back to Lipscomb Hall. You entered through the back door, which was propped open, so the night desk monitor, a woman named Beth Tyndall, did not record your entry. Upstairs, both you and Nancy showered and dressed for the evening. You were wearing saddle loafers, black jeans, a man's white button-up shirt, and an embroidered silver and gold vest. You had silver bangles on your wrist and a locket that belonged to your sister around your neck. Later, Nancy could not recall whether or not you brought back from the communal showers the wire basket you kept your toiletries in. They were not found in your dorm room. Nancy mentions in one of her statements that abandoned items in the bathrooms were generally either stolen or thrown away. At 9:30 p.m., you met your friends at the Manhattan Cafe, where you were told that the Michael Stipe rumor was false. Someone mentioned that the band was touring in Asia. Someone else said they were in California. There was an overall sense of disappointment, but it was agreed that you all might as well stay for drinks. It was Monday night. Everyone but you had classes the next day, a fact that later worked to your disadvantage because Nancy assumed you had gone home to finish your laundry, and we assumed that you were at school. The first round was Pabst Blue Ribbon, which the Manhattan served for a dollar each. At some point later, you were seen holding a Moscow Mule, a cocktail that sold for $4.50 and featured vodka, Blenheim ginger ale, and lime. Nancy Griggs indicated that a man must have purchased the drink because all the girls had a habit of asking for the expensive cocktail whenever a man was paying. A song you liked came on the jukebox. You started dancing. Someone said the song was by CNC Music Factory. Others said it was Lisa Lisa. Regardless, your enthusiasm was contagious. Soon, what little floor space there was in the club was taken up with dancers. That night, there was no particular boy you seemed to favor. All of your friends told the sheriff that you danced because you loved dancing, not because you were trying to attract men. So you weren't an evil temptress, though the sheriff tried his best to make that part of your story. At exactly 10:38 p.m., you told Nancy that you had a headache and were going to return to the dorm. She knows this was the time because she looked at her watch. She asked you to stay until 11, at which point you could walk back to the dorm together. You told her you couldn't wait that long, and to try to be quiet when she got in. The sheriff must have asked Nancy about your level of intoxication because he writes in his notes that Nancy said you were not showing a high level of intoxication, but that you kept yawning and seemed unfocused. The last sentence in Nancy's signed statement simply reads, "After 10:38 p.m., I never saw her again." No one saw you after that. At least, no one who didn't mean you harm. Nancy's last sentence is on the last page in your file. There is nothing more we know. As the sheriff might say, we don't have anything farther. Here is something the sheriff does not know and that your mother refuses to believe. I remember looking at my watch that night. It was a few minutes later, closer to 11, most likely the time you were taken. We were having a late dinner at Harry Bissett's Grill on Broad Street, roughly 5 blocks away from the Manhattan. Your mother was downstairs using the restroom. The waiter offered to bring the check. I looked at my watch. That was when I noted the time. Your little sister was home studying with a friend, but she was old enough to put herself to bed, so I decided to order your mother's favorite dessert. I remember watching her walk back up the stairs. I couldn't stop smiling because your mother was particularly beautiful that night. Her hair was pulled back. She was wearing a white cotton dress that curved around her hips. Her skin glowed. There was so much life in her eyes. When she smiled at me, I felt like an explosion had gone off inside my heart. I could not possibly love her more than I loved her in that moment. My wife, my friend, the woman who had given me such kind, thoughtful, beautiful children. She sat across from me at the table. I took both her hands in mine. "Why are you smiling?" she asked. I kissed the inside of her wrists and answered what I felt at that moment was the absolute truth. "Because everything is perfect." This is what I know that I am. A fool. Chapter 3. She had just buried her husband. Claire kept repeating the words in her head, as if she were narrating a story rather than experiencing the event in her actual life. Claire Scott had just buried her husband. There was more, because the service had been long with many moving parts that Claire recalled with her cold narrator's eye. The casket was gunmetal gray with a blanket of white lilies covering the closed lid. The smell of wet earth was pungent as the machine lowered his body into the grave. Claire's knees went weak. Her grandmother stroked her back. Her mother offered her arm. Claire shook her head. She thought of strong things. Iron. Steel. Paul. It was not until they were climbing into the back of the black limousine that Claire truly understood that she would never see her husband again. She was going home, back to their home, the home that they had shared. People would meet her there, parking their cars along the curving driveway and spilling into the street. They would make toasts. They would tell stories. In his will, Paul had requested a wake, though Claire had been too hung up on the derivation of the word to call it that. She asked herself, wake as in, maybe Paul will wake up? Wake as in, the disturbed trail of water left behind a boat. Claire felt the second wake made the most sense. The calm had been disturbed. She was trapped in turbulent waters, swimming against grief, drowning in sympathy. There had been so many phone calls and cards and flower arrangements and notices of donations that had been made in Paul's name. Architecture for Humanity, Habitat for Humanity, the American Cancer Society, though Paul had not died of cancer. Was there a charity for murder victims? Surely this was something Claire should have looked into. Was it too late? 4 days had passed since that awful night. The funeral was over. People she hadn't seen or heard from in years had already sent their respects. They kept telling her that she was in their thoughts, that Paul was a good man, that they were there for her. Claire nodded when they said this, at the police station, at the hospital, at the funeral home, at the graveside service, though she wasn't quite sure where there was. How are you holding up? They asked. How are you feeling? Disembodied. That was the word that best described Claire's feelings. She had looked up the definition on her iPad last night to make sure she had it right. Existing without or separated from the body. Lacking any obvious physical source. Again, the second definition fit best because Paul had been her physical source. He had given weight to her life, tied her down to the world when her natural inclination had always been to float above everything, as if it were happening to someone else. She had felt this intense disembodiment for the last 4 days, really from the moment the snake man had told them to turn around. And then the police, the undertaker, asking if she wanted to see the body one last time, and Claire blanching at the word body, and sobbing like a child because she had spent every single second since they had taken Paul from her arms trying to remove the image of her lifeless, murdered husband from her mind. Claire Scott wanted to see her husband again. She did not want to see his body. She stared out the window. They were inching forward in dense Atlanta traffic. The funeral procession had been truncated 2 lights back. Only their limo stayed out ahead. This wasn't like the country, where strangers respectfully pulled over to the side of the road to let mourners pass. They ignored the police officers riding ahead on their motorcycles. They ignored the yellow funeral flags that people had stuck on their cars. They ignored everyone but Claire, who felt like the world was staring into the back of the car trying to catch a glimpse of her grief. She struggled to remember the last time she'd ridden in a stretch limousine. Certainly decades had passed since she rode in any type of car with both her mother and grandmother. That last limo ride must have been a trip to the airport with Paul. The car service had given them an upgrade from the usual sedan.
Are we going to the prom? Paul had asked.
They had been on their way to Munich for an architectural conference. Paul had booked them into the Kempinski. For 6 blissful days, Claire swam laps in the pool, had massages and facials, ordered room service, and shopped alongside wealthy Middle Eastern wives whose husbands were in Germany for health care. Paul would join her in the evenings for dinners and late-night strolls along the Maximilianstrasse. If she thought about it hard enough, she could remember what it felt like to hold his hand as they passed the darkened windows of all the closed shops. She would never hold his hand again. She would never roll over in bed and rest her head on his chest. She would never see him come down for breakfast wearing those god-awful velour shorts she hated. She would never spend her Saturdays on the couch with him reading while he watched football games, or go to another corporate dinner party or wine tasting or golf tournament. And even if she did, what would be the point if Paul wasn't there to laugh with her about it? Claire opened her mouth for air. She felt as though she was suffocating in the closed limo. She rolled down the window and took great gulps of cold air. "We'll be there soon," her mother said. She was sitting across from Claire. Her hand was wrapped around the liquor decanters in the side console because the sound of the rattling glass was the proverbial fingernails on a blackboard. Her grandmother Jenny buttoned up her coat but said nothing about the cold. Claire rolled up the window. She was sweating. Her lungs felt shaky. She couldn't think beyond the next few hours. There were going to be over 100 people at the house. Paul's partner at the firm, Adam Quinn, had turned the guest list for the wake into a corporate event for Quinn and Scott. A U.S. congressman, several captains of industry and their trophy wives, a handful of hedge fund managers, bankers, restaurateurs, and real estate developers, and countless blowhards Claire had never met before and, frankly, had never wanted to, would soon be tracking through the house. Their house. They lived in Dunwoody, a suburb just outside of Atlanta. The lot had a gentle slope. At its crest had been a small cottage, with a tire swing in the backyard that the bulldozers had raised the first day of construction. Paul had designed their home from the ground up. He knew where every nail and screw was. He could tell you where every single wire led and what it was supposed to control. Claire's contribution to the infrastructure had been to give Paul a label maker, because he loved labeling things. He'd been like Harold with his purple crayon. The modem said modem. The router said router. The cutoff for the water supply had a giant, labeled tag. Every appliance had a label telling the date it had been installed. There were laminated checklists for everything, from winterizing the outdoor spigots to troubleshooting the AV system, which more closely resembled a NASA control board. Managing the house was arguably a part-time job. Every January, Paul gave Claire a list of contractors so she could set up the annual appointments for maintenance on the generator, the geothermal units, the garage doors, the copper gutters, the composite roof, the irrigation system, the well for the irrigation system, the outdoor lighting, the elevator, the gym equipment, the pool equipment, and the security system. And those were just the tasks she could recite off the top of her head. January was less than 2 months away. Who was she supposed to call? Claire always threw away the list after the last workman left. Did Paul have the file somewhere? Would she even know how to find it? Her hands started shaking. Tears filled her eyes. She was overwhelmed by all the things she did not know she needed to do. Her mother asked, "Claire?" Claire wiped away her tears. She tried to logic down the panic. January was next year. The wake was right now. Claire didn't have to be told how to throw a get-together. The caterers would have arrived an hour ago. The wine and liquor had been delivered this morning. As Claire had gotten dressed for the funeral, the gardeners were already out in the yard with their leaf blowers. The pool had been cleaned yesterday evening while the tables and chairs were being unloaded. There were 2 bartenders and 6 servers. Black-eyed pea cakes with shrimp, zucchini and corn fritters, coriander spiced beef fritters, burgundy beet risotto tarts, lemon spiced chicken with dilled cucumbers, pigs in a blanket with mustard, which Claire always threw in as a joke, but was invariably the first thing the caterers ran out of because everyone loved tiny hot dogs. Her empty stomach soured at the thought of all that food. She stared blankly at the liquor decanters in the limo.
Her mother's hand rested lightly on the stoppers. Her yellow sapphire ring was a gift from her second husband, an affable man who had quietly died of a heart attack 2 days after retiring from his dental practice. Helen Reed was 62 years old, but she looked closer to Claire's age than her own. Helen claimed her good skin came from being a librarian for 40 years, which had kept her out of the sun. The fact that they were often mistaken for sisters had been the bane of Claire's younger existence. "Do you want a drink?" Helen asked. Claire's mouth formed a reflexive no, but she said,
"Yes."
Helen pulled out the scotch. "Ginny?" Claire's grandmother smiled. "No, thank you, dear." Helen poured a generous double. Claire's hand shook as she took the glass. She'd taken a Valium this morning, and when that hadn't seemed to work, she'd taken some Tramadol left over from a root canal. She probably shouldn't put alcohol on top of the pills, but Claire probably shouldn't have done a lot of things this week. She threw back the drink. Her mind flashed up the image of Paul throwing back his scotch in the restaurant 4 nights ago. She gagged as the liquid hit her stomach and burned back up her throat. "Goodness," Jenny patted Claire's back. "Are you okay, dear?" Claire winced as she swallowed. She felt a sharp pain in her cheek. There was a small rash of scraped skin where her face had grazed the brick wall in the alley. Everyone assumed the injury had happened during the robbery, not before. Jenny said, "When you were a little girl, I used to give you scotch and sugar for your cough. Do you remember that?"
"Yes, I do."
She smiled at Claire with genuine affection, which was something Claire could not quite get used to. Last year, the old woman had been diagnosed with something called pleasant dementia, which meant that she had forgotten all the perceived slights and neurotic obsessions that had made her such a nasty bitch for the first 8 decades of her life. The transformation had made everyone wary. They were constantly waiting for the old Jenny to rise up, phoenix-like, and burn them all anew. Helen told Claire,
"That was nice that your tennis team showed up."
"It was."
Claire had been shocked that they'd made an appearance. The last time she'd seen them, she was being shoved into the back of a police car.
"They were dressed so impeccably," Jenny said. "You have such lovely friends."
"Thank you,"
Claire said, though she wasn't sure whether they had attended Paul's funeral because they were still her friends or because they couldn't pass up a juicy social event. Their behavior at the cemetery had offered no clues as to which was the truth. They had kissed Claire's cheek and hugged her and told her how sorry they were. And then they had all wandered off while Claire was greeting other mourners. She couldn't hear them, but she knew what they were doing. Picking apart what everyone was wearing, gossiping about who was sleeping with whom, and who had found out, and how much the divorce would cost. Claire had found herself having an almost out-of-body experience, where she floated like a ghost over their heads and heard them whispering,
"I heard Paul was drinking." Why were they in that alley? What did they think would happen in that part of town?
Someone invariably would make the old joke. "What do you call a woman in a black tennis dress? A Dunwoody widow." Claire had been friends with these types of mean girls all of her life. She was pretty enough to be the leader, but she'd never been able to engender the type of fearless loyalty it took to marshal a pack of she-wolves. Instead, she was the quiet girl who laughed at all the jokes, straggled behind them at the mall, sat on the hump in the back seat of the car, and never, ever, ever let them know that she was secretly fucking their boyfriends. Jenny asked, "Which one were you charged with assaulting?" Claire shook her head to clear it.
"She wasn't there,"
And it wasn't assault, it was disorderly conduct. That's an important legal distinction.
Jenny smiled pleasantly.
Well, I'm sure she'll send a card. Everyone loved Paul.
Claire exchanged a look with her mother. Jenny had hated Paul. And she had hated Claire with Paul even more. Jenny had been a young widow when she raised Claire's father on a paltry income from a secretarial job. She wore her struggles like a badge of honor. Claire's designer clothes and jewelry, and the big houses and the pricey cars and the luxury vacations, had come as a personal affront to a woman who had survived the Great Depression, a world war, the death of a husband, the loss of two children, and countless other hardships. Claire could vividly recall the time she'd worn red Louboutins to visit her grandmother. "Red shoes are for toddlers and whores," Jenny had quipped. Later, when Claire had told Paul about the exchange, he'd joked,
"Is it creepy that I'm fine with either?"
Claire put her empty glass back in the console. She stared out the window. She felt so out of time and place that she momentarily didn't recognize the scenery. And then she realized that they were almost home. Home. The word didn't seem to fit anymore. What was home without Paul? That first night, when she got in from the police station, the house seemed suddenly too big, too empty for just one person. Paul had wanted more. He had talked about children on their second date and third date and countless dates thereafter. He had told Claire about his parents, how wonderful they were, how he had been devastated when they died. Paul was 16 when the Scots were killed in a car accident during a freak ice storm. He was an only child. The only relative he'd had left was an uncle who passed away while Paul was in high school. Her husband had made it clear that he wanted a big family. He wanted lots and lots of kids to inoculate himself against loss, and Claire had tried and tried with him until finally she had agreed to go see a fertility expert who had informed Claire that she couldn't have children because she had an IUD and was taking birth control pills. Of course, Claire hadn't shared that information with Paul. She had told her husband that the doctor had diagnosed her with something called an inhospitable womb, which was true because what was more inhospitable than a pipe cleaner stuck up your uterus?
"Almost there," Helen said.
She reached over and touched Claire's knee.
"We'll get through this, sweetheart."
Claire grabbed her mother's hand. They both had tears in their eyes. They both looked away without acknowledging them.
"It's good you have a grave to visit."
Jenny stared out the window with a pleasant smile on her face. There was no telling where her mind was.
"When your father died, I remember standing at his grave and thinking, this is the place where I can leave my grief. It wasn't immediate, of course, but I had somewhere to go, and every time I visited the cemetery, I felt like when I got back into my car, a tiny little bit of grief was gone."
Helen brushed invisible lint from her skirt. Claire tried to summon good memories of her father. She was in college when Helen called to say that he was dead. At the end of his life, her father had been a very sad, very broken man. No one had been surprised when he'd committed suicide. Jenny asked,
"What's that missing girl's name again?"
"Anna Kilpatrick."
The limo slowed as it made the wide turn into the driveway. Helen shifted in her seat to look out the front window.
"Is the gate supposed to be open?"
"I guess the caterers..."
Claire didn't finish the sentence. There were three police cars parked behind the caterer's van.
"Oh, God, what now?"
A policewoman motioned for the limo to park on the pad down from the main house. Helen turned to Claire.
Have you done something?
What?
Claire couldn't believe the question, but then she thought about the Valium and the Tramadol and the scotch and her heartless parole officer who'd said Claire's smart mouth was going to get her in trouble one day, to which Claire had told him that day had come and gone or she wouldn't have a parole officer. Would he really drug test her on the day of her husband's funeral? For the love of God, Helen slid toward the door. Claire, do something about your expression. You look guilty as hell.
I didn't do anything,
Claire said, resurrecting a whiny tone she hadn't deployed since the ninth grade.
Let me handle this.
Helen pushed open the door. Is there a problem, officer? She was using her librarian voice, low and terse and highly annoyed. The cop held up her hand.
You need to step back, lady.
This is private property. I know my rights.
I'm sorry, Claire edged in front of her mother. No wonder she had a problem with authority.
I'm Claire Scott. This is my house.
Can I see some ID?
Helen stamped her foot.
Oh, for God's sakes, are you really here with three police cars to arrest my daughter on the day she put her husband in the ground?
She threw a hand toward Claire.
Does she look like a criminal?
Mother, it's all right. Claire didn't remind her that technically she was a criminal. As part of her parole, the police could trespass all they wanted. She opened her purse to look for her wallet, and then she remembered that the snake man had taken her wallet. Claire saw the tattoo again, the gold-plated fang. The snake man's skin was white, a detail that had startled Claire when she'd relayed it to the detective at the police station. Was it racist to assume that rich white people were only robbed by black or Hispanic gang members? Or had Claire listened to too much rap music in spin class? It was the same thinking that had made her conjure the image of a shiny black gun when it was actually a knife being held to Paul's back. A knife that didn't even look real, but had still managed to murder her husband. The earth started to tremble. Claire felt the vibrations move up from her feet and into her legs.
Claire? Helen said.
They'd been in Napa a few years ago when an earthquake hit. Claire had been thrown from bed, Paul on top of her. They'd grabbed their shoes but little else as they ran past broken water pipes and shattered glass. Insufficient sheer reinforcement mode, Paul had said, standing in the middle of the crowded, broken street in his boxers and undershirt. A newer building would have base isolation bearings, or a quake-resistant sill-anchoring system that could buffer the shearing effect. Listening to him drone on about seismic loading was the only thing that had calmed her.
Claire!
Claire blinked open her eyes. She looked up at her mother, wondering why their faces were so close.
You fainted.
I didn't, Claire argued, though evidence pointed to the contrary. She was lying on her back in her own driveway. The policewoman was standing over her. Claire tried in vain to think of an insect the woman resembled, but honestly, she just looked overworked and tired. The cop said,
"Ma'am, just stay there. There's an ambulance 10 minutes out."
Claire forced away the image of the paramedics who had rushed down the alley with their gurney in tow, the way they had spent less than a minute examining Paul before shaking their heads. Had someone actually said, "He's gone," or had Claire said the words herself? Heard the words. Felt the words. Watched her husband go from being a man to being a body. Claire asked her mother,
"Can you help me up?"
"Ma'am, don't sit up," the cop ordered.
Helen helped her sit up. "Did you hear what the cop said?"
"You're the one who helped me sit up."
"Not that. Someone tried to rob the house."
"Rob the house?"
Claire repeated, because it didn't make sense.
"Why?"
I imagine they wanted to steal things.
Helen's tone was patient, but Claire could tell she was unsettled by the news. The caterers walked in on the burglars. Burglars. The word sounded antiquated in her mother's mouth. Helen continued. There was a fight.